forget mean-spirited.
Yeah, that too. I'm glad you brought it up, though. That was one of the things before the show that I was hoping that you would bring up, because it's just so... These people have no respect for anything. I've never seen anything like it. You know, if this was George Bush giving the State of the Union and a liberal did the exact same to them, they would be crying left and right.
Oh, yeah.
You know? And they would be crying how it's an insult to the presidency and how it's an insult to this, that, and the other. We just laugh at them when they do it. You know, I mean, it's...
Well, in point of fact, I think I ran across an example of that earlier today. Let me see if I can call this up. It happened on one of the Sunday Blabfest shows. Former Bush administration spokescreep or whatever she was, Nicole Wallace.
Mm-hmm.
Conversation cussing and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy!
Sorry about being a minute or so tardy. The production computer having been ignored for the past week or so. Well, let's see. What? Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Monday. Yep. Decided that it was being petulant and didn't want to cooperate. But at any rate, this is the horn. The program is live. It is the 19th day of February, 2013. And we continue apace. Thanks for the welcome back, Lottie, one of our moderators in the chat room. Appreciate it. I got back yesterday evening, but too late to get on the air. So my apologies for that. But what a trip. What a journey. What an amazing coming together of good spirit and goodwill and determination. You may recall that... hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. There, that's taken care of. And let's see, the horn is available on a number of platforms beyond the Listen Live button at headonradionetwork.com. You can also pick up the horn at TuneIn Radio and their smartphone streaming app, or Stitcher Internet Radio and their smartphone streaming app. Other places like dar.fm, streama.com. Podcast address is at headonradionetwork.com. The podcast address is at whiterosesociety.org under the subdomain for this program. And if anybody's still doing it, you can always download the podcast at iTunes. Let's see now. Getting back. Yeah, I left on Thursday and got to northern Wisconsin that evening. Harrowing little ride from Charleston to Atlanta. Hit some turbulence up there that threw us around like a rag doll. I know Lottie enjoys those kind of rides. Me, I don't even get on roller coasters, so. Ick. Oh, yeah, so one of our other chat room moderators, Sparky, noting, saw you on Saturday on the live stream, Bob. Yeah, the event, we streamed it here. We streamed the audio on the horn, and then the event itself was streamed, live streamed via Indian Country TV. As I said, it was an amazing gathering. Whole room full of people. I'd say every bit of 200 people. It was the midwinter social there on the Lac Couderay reservation, not far from Hayward, Wisconsin. I fall in love with that place a little bit more every time I'm up there. I got a real treat in that our friend Janny came down from Duluth to say howdy, and that was fun. We talked a little bit after the event was over with. My thanks go out to our buddy Bruce, who kindly picked me up at the airport in Minneapolis and took me all the way up to the reservation and stayed for the events and had some really, really good conversations. Got to see Shirley. You know, Shirley's monthly challenge comes around every month. Shirley's very happy to sponsor that. The struggle up there in Wisconsin has implications. Just as last year's labor assault on labor launched by Scott Walker had national implications and ramifications, so too does this assault. And it should be understood as being all part of a piece. These are not random acts of right-wingery. These are planned assaults. Last year, it was about trying to destroy the labor movement because it has progressive roots. And this year, it's about trying to destroy the power, the strength of the tribal peoples of northern Wisconsin. I was stunned yesterday when I read an article from the AP, I believe it was, let me find it here, yeah, there it is. Since we missed Moran Monday yesterday, I think it's only fair that we cover a little bit of that ground, especially in the context of what I went up there to try to help with. My whole purpose in being there is to explain the similarities between what a coal baron does in coal lands via strip mining and its associated toxins and poisons, and what he intends for the people of the area near the Bad River and the Pinoki Hills. It was really, really great to share a panel with Bad River Chairman Mike Wiggins and a young woman that I have become acquainted with over the last two panels I've been on, a young woman by the name of Jessica Koski, who is a brilliant young activist. There's a lot of determination there, and it is hopefully going to come together and result in stopping this planned assault on the health and well-being and people of that region, the Bad River watershed. It badly needs national exposure. Badly. It needs to be talked about all over this country because this is another, as I said, another planned assault. This is another installment payment to the Koch brothers and their cronies, their ilk, that ilk, in the ongoing liquidation of everything good and decent about this country. So lo and behold, an article came out . It's kind of a rewrite from the Wisconsin Citizens Media Cooperative. The editor's note, it's by Todd and Dottie Richmond. Walker blames top employer in Ashland County for lack of jobs. I really wish this thing could get coverage. I wish it's a pity that folks like, Ed Schultz, who was deeply involved in covering the Wisconsin struggle last year. It's a pity he's not doing the same thing again, because this is every bit as important as what happened last year. Because, as noted, it is part of an ongoing assault. Last year it was labor's turn. This year it's the environment and public health's turn. But instead, as our buddy Michael pointed out to me yesterday, instead, Big Ed is using his radio airtime to complain that there are too many holidays in America. Right. And it is part of a larger problem, because there were somewhere between 35,000 and 50,000 people on the mall in Washington, D.C. on Sunday, begging for a rejection of the Keystone XL pipeline and for a rational, common-sense approach to the climate catastrophe that is unfolding upon this planet. And again, from the for-profit media, bupkis. Not much at all. At least Big Ed did cover that in a segment last night, I understand. But yeah, he thinks we've got too many holidays in this country, Big Ed does. I have no idea what that means. Are we slacking again? One supposes. But anyway, to go back to the Wisconsin Citizens Media Cooperative, they did a rewrite of a February 12, 2013 AP article and it reads as follows. According to a brief Bad River history description by DJ Jackson, the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa, Ojibwe, Anishinaabe, is one of six Ojibwe bands in Wisconsin that are federally recognized tribes, four of which live on set-aside reservation treaty lands from the Treaty of 1854. These four are Bad River, Red Cliff, Lac de Flambeau, and Lac Couderay. The other two bands are St. Croix and Mole Lake. The Chippewa, or Ojibwe Nation, is one of the three largest native nations in North America. The Bad River Band has lived peaceably since that treaty in the evergreen forests and sloughs of northern Wisconsin, along the big water of Lake Superior, living off wild rice, fish, and game. This is a brilliant rewrite because there's a lot of interlineations and corrections. For instance, where the AP article says, the Bad River Band has quietly carved out a hard scrabble existence. Jesus. The article instead says, and the rewrite says, the Bad River Band has lived peaceably since that treaty in evergreen forest. And so, right. They grapple with racist neighbors and retaining their rights under the Treaty of 1854 every day. In the Koch brothers' subsidiary of Fitzwalkerstan, formerly known as the state of Wisconsin, and before that, Turtle Island, tribal members find themselves on the long end of a well-funded public relations effort that hinges on the false rhetorical promise to create new jobs in Wisconsin. This is the Pinoki mining crisis. So here's the nut of it. Here's what makes Scott Walker a fresh nominee for More in Monday a day late here on Titanic Tuesday. This also qualifies as Titanic right-wing brains. The bottom line is that Scott Walker has accused the Bad River Tribe, which is the single largest employer in Ashland County, Wisconsin, of standing in the way of, I'm sorry, that was probably the wrong voice for up there, standing in the way of jobs. And remember, we spell that J-A-W-B-Z-Z-Z-Z-Z-Z, jobs. Never mind whether you get cancer. Never mind whether you get poisoned. Never mind. No, look the other way. Jobs. Right? Iron mining was, and the AP article says, once the area's lifeblood, and the correction says, iron mining was a boom-bust industry that never provided permanent job security or safe working conditions, but the last mine closed in 1965. Much larger mines in China, Brazil, and Australia outcompeted the smaller North American operations. But, as with everything, they're back! And so, having failed last year, the Republican-dominated legislature of the state of Wisconsin is back to try to rewrite some of the best, they are among the best state environmental laws in this country, so that they can get allow a coal baron from West Virginia named Chris Klein to blast the hell out of these pristine hills and pristine waters and poison everything within his reach. The bill will clear the House of the State Assembly, and the fight is in the Senate, because there's a whole bunch of teabagging booger eaters in the State Assembly, and it's just going to go through there like poop through a goose. In the Senate, however, it's a matter of a couple of Republicans. They need to turn two members of the Republican Party, the Republican caucus, in the state Senate of Wisconsin. One of those senators just happens to represent the area in which the Lac Qui Duray reservation is located. When I looked out over the room on Saturday, I couldn't help noticing that there were probably enough people in there to put him out of work. On the other hand, he has also taken some $100,000 or so from the mining companies that hope to profit by destroying how do I begin to describe what a beautiful place that is up there? Now, everybody who's got any time at all listening to this program knows I am a winter sissy. Oh, it's cold. Oh, my poor feet. I've learned lessons. Oh, the lessons I've learned in the last week. As Bruce told me, it's all about knowing how to dress for it. And we did. Got me a warm hat, warm coat, warm boots. No problem. It is colder back here in the Horn Studio right now than I was the entire time that I was up in northern Wisconsin. And there's something, you know, for the hillbilly mouse to go up to the upper Midwest and find out what cold really means, it was exhilarating. And yes, I am somewhat of a simpleton in cultural things like this. I saw snowmobiles in use, and it looked like a heck of a lot of fun. Assuming that you're not just liquored up out of your brains trying to do it. And apparently, that's a big part of the fun that didn't grab me as being smart. But all that white, all that snow, the frozen lakes. People were out having a blast in those near zero temperatures and sub-zero temperatures. And daggum if it isn't worth saving. But the heat is on right now. In the next couple of weeks, a vote could be taken in the Wisconsin Senate on this mining bill that was written, incidentally, by the mining company that will determine which way this struggle goes. And it's kind of a reminder of the nature of our fight, I think. You can't just beat these parasites once, because they come back. They come back, and they come back, and they come back. And they've got horse-gagging loads of money, so you have to stay almost constantly mobilized to beat them. They were beaten back last year. They have to be beaten back this year. But one of the things I was saying a few minutes ago is that this is getting shockingly little mention in the wider progressive media universe or the for-profit media universe. That badly needs to change. I would love to hear tribal chairman Mike Wiggins talk about this to say Sam Cedar or Hartman, and get people understanding that this fight that they've got on their hands out there is going to have reverberations all around the country. Because if those environmental laws can be stricken, none of us are safe. None of us. Just because what's being gone after is an iron ore and not some hydrocarbon nightmare does not make it any less important. It is vitally important. Just driving through the region and seeing those rolling, you know, those rolling hills and those frozen lakes. And yeah, it's kind of a shock to my hillbilly system to look at a bunch of vehicles driven out and parked on a lake and people drilling, you know, augering holes in the ice to go fishing, but it looks awful fun, too. And guess what? I don't know if the sports folks who enjoy doing things like ice fishing know it, but that goes away. That goes away when the land and the waters are toxified. It goes away. But at least the people that I spoke to Saturday understand the nature and the importance of the effort. Now the question is how we can go about getting the information further. On Facebook, if you want to follow what's going on there, You can, hold on here, let me get it. Tell you the name of the group to follow. Citizens concerned about the proposed Pinoki mine. Just about everything you could want to know in following this effort is there. Citizens concerned about the proposed Pinoki, that's P-E-N-O-K-E-E, mine. Follow them on Facebook if you do the Facebook thing. Follow among other people. Follow Mike Wiggins Jr. because he is a leader in this effort, and he is a leader overall of real talent. Get involved in this. It's worth your effort. Make your voice heard. And for God's sakes, if you live in Wisconsin, don't just sit there. Make it known that you stand with the Bad River Tribe. Talk to your neighbors. Don't be afraid. Not at all. Even though it's a little chilly back here in the studio. I'm as warm as toast. Because I got my hat. It's a Stormy Cromer. And your head cannot be cold in one of these things. Really neat. It's American-made. It's even got a lifetime guarantee on it. If you lose it, they'll replace it for half price. How many others are there like that? In this day and age, not many. Not many at all. Never would have known about them had I not gone up there. Never would have known about Friday Fish Fry. And you know what this is the food porn portion of the program, but it's nothing like it. It's a very special place. And it speaks deeply to me. Because they have an opportunity to keep it special instead of seeing it despoiled by these predators. Lord, I hope. This can be one. But it's going to take a lot of people being absolutely committed to winning this struggle. I'd never been to anything like what I witnessed Saturday evening. And I will forever be thankful to the governing board of the Lac Coeur d'Alene band and all the people who made me so welcome up there. It is a transformative experience. I also want to thank folks who have been kicking in support of the $500 challenge that went out on Wednesday. We have met about 40% of it, and that means a lot. Got a note from our pal Cindy. She said, I've been laid up pretty hard for a while. I missed weeks of Malloy and you. First time in 10 years I missed either show. Imagine how unhappy I was not to get your signal when I could fire up the computer. Went to the site and saw the money problem. Immediately shot some cash to you. Hope you got it. We did. Thank you. She says, I'm very proud of your work for Coal River Mountain Watch, too, and their associated groups, like the AIC campaign. She says, we love you out here, tickling our airwaves and brains. Thank you, Cindy. Thank you very, very much. And I miss being away from the microphone, but at least I was able to get the stream out. I need to... I got a stream out of the event on Saturday. I need to get that up to Ben for podcasting purposes, and I will after the program. And we're working on. I'm trying to figure out a way if we can do it once we get out of the woods. And well, we live in the woods here as far as keeping this all on the air, but I'm trying very hard to figure out a way to get the toll-free number back, because that meant a lot to people. And we've got to end that hostage situation in which the toll-free number is being held hostage. And we'll try. We'll keep plugging right along. You know, after having been involved with something as profound as what I was over the weekend, it's a little difficult to jump back into the swamp. It's not even, no, it's not a swamp. Swamps are good things. It's more like jumping into a cesspool. A cesspool of meanness and stupidity and ignorance and, yeah. But it's all out there, and it's kind of hard to avoid. And it is Titanic Tuesday, which is a continuation of Moran Monday. And consequently, we have, for all of our delectation this evening, the stirring words of a congressman by the name of Joe Heck. He's a Republican in every sense of the word, from Nevada. Nevada. Tomato, tomato. Potato, potato. Let's call the whole thing off. And this Joe Heck creature went on a radio show with some 532nd tier right winger by the name of Alan Stock to object to the presence of Gabrielle Giffords at last week's State of the Union address. I had to listen to it already. All we got in common is our misery, and the least we can do is share it. These are the stunning, stirring words of Representative Joe Heck of Nevada.
Not all of them, but a few of them are going after our guns. It's a gun grab out of D.C. and by some of your colleagues from the other side of the aisle. But, you know, they're out there, and it's just amazing. At the end of the president's State of the Union, when he said, have a vote for Gabby Giffords, have a vote for this and that. I mean, I found that to be nauseating. And you know what else is nauseating too? Is putting Gabby Giffords up there, who can't even clap her hands as a figure of gun, somebody having shot her. And I think that is just a shameful act by putting her up there as a prop. I'm sorry, I really did.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think there's, again, in the cloud of emotion that's surrounding the unfortunate incident in Connecticut, that those that are anti-gun or want to use that as their opportunity to try to limit the Second Amendment, our Second Amendment rights. And so it's incumbent upon those of us, certainly in the House and hopefully members that are in the Senate, to look at what things can be done to try to keep a weapon out of the hand of somebody who has the propensity to do harm, but not limit law-abiding citizens from owning weapons.
Charming, isn't it? Yeah, no, I agree. What do you agree with, Congressman Heck? You agree with Alan Stock, who says that a woman who was shot through the brain is just a prop? Piece of stagecraft. Not even really a human being. Well, the Brown stuff did hit the fan, and so a statement went out from representing Heck's office. He said, my statement was in reference to the idea of gun control grab coming out of Washington, D.C. Of course, there's no way that I think that Gabby Giffords is a prop, except for the fact that he said that he agrees that she's a prop. Should I have come to her defense? You know, in a fast-moving interview, in retrospect, I should have said something, but I didn't. I was just looking to get past that and talk about gun control in general. Yeah, he was just looking to get past talking about the effects of a culture that has absolutely gone out of its mind over firearms. Should I have come to her defense? He would not have come to her defense under any set of circumstances. He agreed. She's a prop. What else did he agree with? Let's look at that. He agrees that she is nauseating. Gabby Giffords is nauseating. She's a nauseating prop. And there's the reality of the right wing for you. Revolting, isn't it? Pathetic. Limiting Second Amendment rights. Making somebody go through a background check at a gun show, closing the gun show loophole, doesn't limit anyone's Second Amendment rights. Republicans love regulations until they don't love them. They want to regulate women's bodies. They want to regulate, well, this falls under what regulate, well, it's a different story. Okay, so in Alabama, Stan, they're down for some regulating. In Alabama, Stan, the geniuses are at work. They're trying to use the usual, the same old tawdry tactics to make it regulatorily, regulatorily impossible for an abortion clinic to operate, a women's reproductive health care center. Applying really stupid rules about how wide the halls have to be, for instance. But then along comes representing Mary Sue McClurkin, slurking. Sounds like a bubble in a bathtub. Along comes representing Mary Sue McClurkin, who told the Montgomery Advertiser, and this is truly precious, why she wants to make sure abortion can't happen in Alabamistan. And this is kind of a new one. Mary Sue McClurkin, in referring, an abortion procedure, said, when a physician removes a child from a woman, that is the largest organ in a body. That's a big thing. That's a big surgery. You don't have any other organs in your body that are bigger than that. Yes, you know, those little moments that make you feel like pretty much the culture might, you know, we're just toast, aren't we? That woman made it all the way to the House of Representatives of the state of Alabamistan, thinking that a fetus is a bodily organ. It's an organ, you know, like your eyes. It's an organ, like your liver, or your kidneys, or your heart, or your brain. It's an organ, that fetus. I guess us males of the species are just organ challenged. Or maybe, hey, who knows? Maybe all them sperms are organs too. Dear God, I never knew it was surgery. Well, let's not think about that. It takes the fun out of it. But isn't that a little insulting to the fetus, too? I thought it was a fully formed human being. Unless we're going to go down the road now where, what? Where organs are people, too? What's next, broccoli? Yes, sir. That's a big thing. That's a big surgery. Meanwhile, a decent human being, Representative Patricia Todd of Birmingham, said they're drafting a bill on a subject they have no knowledge of. I think we can take that as read. They've never been in a clinic. They don't know what the regulations are. They also need to hop on the magic school bus for a refresher on the... No, that's editorial from the writer of the article. They also need to hop on the magic school bus for a refresher in how the human body operates. They're going to pass they're going to pass a law offered up by Representative Mary Sue McClurkin, friend of Jesus. To try to make it so that a woman can't get necessary health care when she needs it. Because fetuses are organs. Going back to representing Heck, a note from Darlene, who says, a what the moment. As someone who is also differently abled, what the does it matter that Gabby Giffords can't clap? Just what the hell does that mean? What a bonehead repig-licking. She can't clap, so she can't participate? She can't have a point of view in the gun control debate? Yeah. Well, you know what? John McCain can't raise his arms above his shoulders. I guess he's out, too. No, he was on the Sunday talk shows hollering Benghazi again this weekend. Well, different standards, I suppose. Helen Keller could neither see nor hear nor for many years speak. I suppose in representing Heck's world, she would just, well, I imagine she could probably clap. God, they're obnoxious. They're revolting. Representing Heck has apparently gotten under Jim's skin, too. Gifford's a prop? That's the subject line. What the hell is the Speaker of the House with his determination to destroy the government through sequestration? What was on the horizon is now the enemy at the gates, and they will do it. Have they sent no sense of decency? No, says Jim. They do not. I guess it's okay to be a prop if you're orange. And Merlot-sodden. Jeebus. Then, with regard to Marco Rubio, a note from our pal Sergi. He says, evening, Bob. Evening, Sergi. I was catching up on last week's shows earlier today, and I am now listening to the live show. I couldn't help but email you with a comment and a question regarding Marco Rubio. I get the impression that he was handpicked by the higher-ups in the Republican Party to run to show, hey, look, we've got a Latino, too. They sure seem to make a big deal about that. I also think he is congratulated when he makes a public appearance such as that on the State of the Union with backroom accolades such as that given to a dog when he or she performs a good trick. Also true. Therefore, I have started referring to the senator with a nickname referencing both of my above points. Oh, my. This is good. This one has legs. Senator Chimichanga, good boy. My question is, before I start using this in a real widespread fashion, is to get a poll of you and the listeners as to the inquiry, is this racially offensive or a good satirical nickname? I'm leaning toward good satirical nickname, but again, we'll poll the Horn family and get an idea. The only difference being that, well, technically, well, no, never mind. Well, a chimichanga is Tex-Mex, you know, whereas Rubio is Cubano. But that's semantic, I think. Chimichanga, good boy. But you know how, like, with the idiocy of the of Mary Sue McClurkin and fetuses being bodily organs, sometimes it does get frustrating, and you think that the culture really is in trouble. After his goofball attempt to sneak a drink of water, in which just about everybody agreed that Marco Rubio, not his finest moment. Well, when life gives you lemons, you make lemonade, right? The man has raised over $100,000 selling water bottles with his name on them. They go to anybody who makes a $25 or more donation to Rubio's pack. They've hustled out more than 3,000 water bottles. With the saying, send the liberal detractors a message that not only does Marco Rubio inspire you, he hydrates you too. Because, you know, the Republicans can't help it when they see a person with a vowel on the end of their names. The only thing they can think of is somebody watering their yard. He hydrates you too. Bad day to quit sniffing glue. $100,000. because he's an inept. A yahoo. A laughingstock. Stunning, isn't it? No, it's not. It's just another day in another day in the fading empire. She's a prop. Prop. Sure. Why not? But there's ever so much more than that. And the Titanic brains are out in force. In the wake of the State of the Union, when we didn't talk that much about... Well, in the wake of the State of the Union, the usual... And by usual, I mean it's been going on for the last 75 years. The usual response to the idea of raising the minimum wage was that it would, you know, the Pigwickans would really, oh, collapse the economy! And they get to use it over and over again, and nobody ever says, you know, you people are a bunch of liars. Can't you at least come up with a new lie? The economy has never been collapsed by raising the minimum wage. Did you ever consider, has anybody ever seen Marsha Blackburn and Michelle Bachmann in the same room? Because I'm beginning to think that Marsha Blackburn is just Michelle Bachmann with a better dye job. That woman complained about the proposed minimum wage hike by referencing the minimum wage for her first job back in the Mesozoic era. She's been on rather of a tear lately. She doesn't like the idea of universal preschool either. But this one was just precious. Because it turns out that the minimum wage that she signed on at, yeah, back in the Cenozoic, Jurassic, one of those eras, would actually work out to being about $12 an hour today. But we can't be counting on Marsha Blackburn to be doing any, you know, brains stuff. Her, you know, that vacuum inside her head might collapse her skull. There she is. Just had to go find her, that's all. Yeah, so here's the argument she put forward. You'll enjoy this.
From And from school teachers is that there needs to be a lower entry level so that you can get 16, 17, 18-year-olds into the process. Chuck, I remember my first job when I was working in a retail store growing up down there in Laurel, Mississippi. I was making like $2.15 an hour, and I was being taught how to responsibly handle those customer interactions, right. And I appreciated that opportunity.
Isn't that special? She did. She appreciated that opportunity at $2.15. And yeah. There's only one problem, and that's this. If you advance those $2.15 an hour that she made somewhere between 1968 and 1970, and you inflated them to present dollar values, her minimum wage entry-level job was somewhere around $12.72 to $14.18 an hour in modern money. Over at Think Progress, they noted that it turns out that she was making almost double the wage she now says is keeping teenagers out of the workforce. But it's the same old argument, and it never turns out to be true. But it keeps on, keeps on, keeps on being advanced, and who helps advance it? Well, that interview was given to MSNBC. And I assume Chuck Todd. You'll notice there was no audio of the pushback where he says, "Why, madam, that's $12.72 an hour in modern money." So it's not just a matter of, you know, the right way, greedy teenagers. But we're not talking about teenagers' jobs. This is America. This is America where you work for minimum wage and you'll take two or three jobs. Remember George W. Bush said it was uniquely American to work three jobs? Yeah. It's one of those forms of uniqueness with which I am not particularly thrilled. Said it was uniquely American to work three jobs. And those are adults. Those are mommies and daddies working those jobs. With no health care. More on that in a minute. Now let's do that right now. Lindsey Graham Cracker, who of course was making the rounds of the Sunday BS fests on the TV, showed up on Fox News Sunday to talk about the sequester. And you know, Lindsey Graham Cracker is very, very serious about the sequester. He loves him some military. The sequester would wind up being about a 7.5% reduction in the Pentagon budget. And, of course, the members of Congress, many of whom are essentially subsidized by the military-industrial complex, that's why it's a military-industrial-congressional complex, well, that 7.5% reduction at the Pentagon would, in the words of Lindsey Graham Cracker, destroy the military. He also happens to be a liar, because now the Repiglicans are running around saying, "Oh, sequester, that was that Kenyan Muslim socialist idea. We didn't have anything to do with it." When they had everything to do with it. But Lindsey Graham Cracker told Chris Wallace, he said, "Well, all I can say is the commander-in-chief thought it came up with the idea." You know who Lindsey Graham Cracker reminds me of, voice-wise? The creepy old guy on Family Guy. Well, all I can say is the commander-in-chief thought you came up with the idea of sequestration, destroying the military and putting a lot of good programs at risk. It is my belief, take Obamacare and put it on the table. You can make $86,000 a year in income and still get a government subsidy under Obamacare. Obamacare is destroying health care in this country, and people are leaving the private sector because their companies cannot afford to offer Obamacare. And if you want to look at ways to find $1.2 trillion in savings over the next decade, look at Obamacare. Don't destroy the military and cut blindly across the board. I guess Lindsey Graham Cracker was somewhere else when he voted for the sequestration, because he did. That must have been his evil twin. Huckleberry Closet case. God, I love Charlie Pierce. So what's he want? What's it? Well, the upshot of what Lindsey Graham Cracker wants would take health care coverage away from 30 million American citizens. 30 million. To keep 7.5% of an already outrageously overblown and bloated Pentagon budget in the budget. See how that works? Yeah. Jeebus. So, let's see. Marsha Blackburn doesn't like people making a decent minimum wage. Lindsey Graham Cracker doesn't like people having health care. Jesus. I know I vacillate. I know I go back and forth. And I know there's a lot of people like, yeah, hell yeah. Why don't you? No, don't have them secede. Let's kick them out this time. And I've been reading a bunch of that era history, and it's all through my head. And it's had an interesting discussion while I was up in Wisconsin about the fact that of what would have been the outcome had Lincoln not been reelected in 1864. What would have been the outcome? Lindsey Graham, South Carolina, Joe Heck, Nevada, Marsha Blackburn, Tennessee. You know, when I was working my first job down there in Laurel, Mississippi, which of course you know by now, only just recently got around to actually ratifying the 13th Amendment to the Constitution. Oops. Jack writes in, water bottle, Rubio, I'm not quite sure what to think about the party of water pollution selling water bottles. Well, they're selling to Republicans, so hopefully I'm sure that these are non-socialist, BPA-free water bottles, so you can at least hope for that. Yeah. So, there goes this evening's filibuster. We'll take a little break. It's time for the Green News Report with Brad Friedman and Desi Doyen. Always enjoy those. And, of course, conversation radio means we converse. So the lines are open and functioning. They were pre-tested before the show. They really work. Hear the dial tone? Sure you do. 304-658-3333 gets you into the program, as does Skype. The handle at Skype, Bob Kincaid Horn. BobKincaidHorn. and you're free to jump into the program any way you see fit between those two choices. Or email, of course, bobkincaid@gmail.com. And ever so much more, well, here, let's go out. There she was. Look how far she's come since that first job in retail back in Laurel, Mississippi. Here's Marcia Blackburn on Universal Preschool. You know, Universal Preschool that keeps children from... you have higher retention rates, high school graduation, stuff like that. Right. Nope. It's no good. Probably Kenyan Muslim socialism.
What do you make of some of the things he talked about, like early education? We saw the president in Georgia yesterday, fairly close to where you're from, talking about preschool access expansions, other early education proposals.
You know, I had an email from a teacher as they were giving the speech at someone I've known for a long time, and it was, "Are you kidding me? More paperwork." And I think so many of our educators, when they hear these programs coming from the federal government, they're just thinking, oh, that's another book of paperwork that I'm going to have to do. And teachers are so weighed down with that. The teachers I'm talking to, they want state and local control, site-based decision making. They do not want the federal government. Indeed, they'd just like to see the states with control of education and would much
states
prefer
rights.
That. Than having the federal government come up with this initiative and that initiative. And, you know, they know what works. Let them educate children. Let them teach.
If there was local control in your home district, would you approve of the ideas of expanded preschool access? And
We have different schools and programs in some communities that are doing that. They're doing it working with the parents, with the teachers. Let them do it. Don't put something out here from the federal government that is going to be another... incentive to pull you in, and then they yank the money, and then you've got local governments that are left. Let teachers and parents make these decisions.
Is it just me, or was that word salad? The girl from Laurel. Marcia Blackburn. Super genius. So it is time for the Green News Report and the end of the filibobster. Light up the phones if you're out there. 304-658-3333. It is Titanic Tuesday on the horn. Listener supported, I might add. The listener supported horn. And thanks for keeping it going. PayPal buttons at headonradionetwork.com. So is the snail mail address, 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB 318, Beckley, BECKLEYWV 25801. Boss Man Wayne gets sad when there's an echo in the mailbox. We'll be back. This is the horn. Little girl.
It's Tuesday, February
19, 2013. We are unstoppable! Another world is possible!
Because oil will spill. It's just a matter of when.
We're here today to send a strong message to the president.
If you fail to act now to deal with this crisis, that is a gun pointed at the head of the future.
All hands on deck for the largest climate rally in U.S. history.
First of all, focus on things that, even if there wasn't climate change, we should want to do anyway.
But is President Obama all talk and no action? Secret memo reveals tar sands are poisoning Alberta, Canada. Plus,
during the year ahead, we'll encourage use of electric vehicles by installing curbside battery charges at sites throughout the city.
Mayor Bloomberg's big plans to electrify and greenify New York City.
All of that and more straight ahead from bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
On one of the coldest days in
Washington. Maybe that was it. Maybe one had the icicles on their lips and he would move. Fracking!
We're dying here.
Yes, you are, Fox News. Literally. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, the largest climate rally in U.S. history took place on Sunday in Washington, D.C.,
yep.
And it was covered on exactly zero
of the Sunday chat shows, according to Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting.
Yeah, the Sunday news shows haven't caught up with the rest of us yet. But the network news shows did cover the climate rally, and that's a point in their favor.
They gave it a few words, not nearly enough, frankly, especially when you've got 35,000 people gathered in the freezing cold in D.C. to protest. I bet if those were Tea Partiers, it would have been across every single Sunday show and every single network news.
Well, it was indeed a huge rally. An estimated 35 to 50,000 people turned out in the bitter cold to demand President Barack Obama reject the controversial Keystone XL pipeline project. The Forward on Climate rally, organized by the Sierra Club and 350.org, with over a dozen satellite rallies in cities around the country, demonstrated the widespread support for the president to deny the cross-border permit to the pipeline. They say the president must reject the pipeline to show he is serious about taking action on climate change. Here's former White House Green Jobs Advisor Van Jones.
All the good that you have done, all the good you can imagine doing, will be wiped out by floods, by fires, by superstorms, if you fail to act now to deal with this crisis that is a gun pointed at the head of the future.
Now, they say the Keystone XL is both a symbol and a matter of principle. As Grist.org put it, quote, we must cease making large long-term capital investments in new fossil fuel infrastructure that locks in dangerous emission levels for many decades. And the most recent poll from the League of Conservation Voters shows two-thirds of Americans want Obama to act to address climate change. In an online video chat late last week, President Obama sounded like he will act.
We have to do something that's really difficult for any society to do, and that is to take actions now where the benefits are going to be coming down the road, or at least we're going to be avoiding big problems down the road.
However, after a disappointing meeting with White House staffers on whether Obama would use executive action to establish emission standards for existing power plants, Philip Bump of Grist warns, don't hold your breath. I guess it depends on which Obama decides to show up and how strong the public pressure is on him.
You know, we're coming up on the 10th anniversary of the Iraq War. That was a disaster that could have been averted had we paid attention to the largest protests of all times. The fact that the media still is not giving proper deference to these huge protests suggests that, well, we are likely to make the very same mistake once again.
And in addition to the inevitable oil spills and the impact of emissions from the tar sands on climate, the tar sands are also polluting Alberta, Canada. An internal Canadian government memo revealed this week shows new scientific evidence that toxic tar sands tailing ponds that are supposed to store toxic waste sludge forever are leaking toxins into the environment and groundwater, despite repeated denials of officials.
Who would have thunk it?
Finally, despite inaction in D.C., Mayor Michael Bloomberg is taking action to greenify New York City. He announced in his State of the City address that the city plans to install 10,000 electric vehicle charging stations and ban styrofoam containers to free up landfill space.
Imagine that, New York leading the way. Perhaps it's those two largest storms in our history that have slammed into them over the past 3 or 4 months. Maybe that'll do it. For more on all of the stories we got to today and those we couldn't get to, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. While you're there, please consider a donation to help sponsor the Green News Report so we can stay on the air and tell you what's going on, even when your Sunday network news shows won't. From bradblog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
New York. Like a scene from all those movies, but you're real enough to me. But there's a heart that lives in New York, a heart in New York, a rose on the street.
About 20 minutes past the hour, almost halfway through this Tuesday evening, this Titanic Tuesday edition of The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid, and I want to, well, kind of keep going along the same track we were on. Couple of notes. Andy writing in. Subject line, sequestration was trumpeted by Speaker Boehner as a great achievement. Thoroughly happy. When Speaker Boehner cut the sequestration deal with Mr. Obama, he exclaimed, paraphrasing,
I got 99% of what I wanted. Thoroughly happy with it.
Now, says Andy, the Republicans are not happy with it, trying to pin it on Mr. Obama, an amazing rewrite of history. De rigueur for the Republicans. Normal operating procedure to squeeze more out of the working class. And the more I think of it, if you catch me saying middle class, lower class, blah, 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 if you catch that, shoot me a note. Hey, Bob. No. It's working class and not working class. There are those who sign checks and those who get checks signed for them. If somebody's signing your check and you're making $250,000 a year, you're still part of the working class. Working class. Andy's been doing some activist work, by the way. I wanted to share this with you. This came in while I was gone, but I wanted to make sure that I did save it. Andy's been working hard out there for the AIC Act, H.R. 526. You know, you can learn everything you need to know about ending Appalachia's agony by going to AICACT.org, ACHEACT.org. Andy writes, over the weekend, February 16th, on Saturday, I participated in a Representative Jackie Speer town hall. I was able to submit a card explaining H.R. 526 and the AIC Act, and then at the end I was able to address Ms. Speer directly with the same information from a microphone at the side of the hall in a line of citizen petitioners. She's very sympathetic to the cause and voiced that opinion from the submit card and directly to my verbal dialogue. Evidently, she heard the evidence and some of your folks at a congressional hearing. Unfortunately, when I asked her whether she would co-sponsor the bill, crickets. When I explained in the last congressional session's bill, we had 10 California House member co-sponsors. In this session's bill, we have 5 co-sponsors from California, including local representatives Jared Huffman, Barbara Lee, and Mike Honda. Still crickets. I asked her twice if she would co-sponsor the bill. I got no response. Her gatekeeper staffer holding the microphone was getting upset with me as I explained the health effects of mountaintop removal and pressed on. The bottom line, as with most politicians, she talks a good game, but when it comes to action that puts a wrench on the capitalist money-making, death-producing externality machine, that's another story. She can't say none of her constituents are unaware of your efforts to fix a wrong in Appalachia, so we still have a work in progress. Thanks, Andy. No, thank you, Andy. It's this kind of work that will pass, that will ultimately pass the bill. We can't let them hide from what is happening here. Because again, just as what I said about the struggle in northern Wisconsin, these things have national implications. If you were listening to just a couple of minutes ago to the Green News Report, the Canadian government has tried to bury or sink at the bottom of some sludge pond the fact that people are being poisoned by tar sands extraction in Alberta. And it's the same thing with climate change. There's tons of evidence, science. Peer-reviewed, sound, non-speculative science out there that says that all of this poisons people. What we can't seem to do is get them to own up to the reality. Just say it. We don't care if we poison some folks. We're making money doing it. Just say that. But they won't say that in Alberta, they won't say it in northern Wisconsin, and they damn sure won't say it in Appalachia. Because they're afraid that people might not take kindly to it now, aren't they?
But it is the truth. It is absolutely the truth. They're poisoners. Poisoning is what they do. And as long as they make money doing it, we're supposed to be okay with it, as long as they say, energy independence, jobs! How much energy independence is there in a planet that will not sustain human life? Or in a region that won't sustain human life? Or in having cancer clusters blossom like dandelions after a spring rain? Not damn much by my estimate. Nice note coming in from our pal Harry, recently decamped from D.C. to Baltimore. He said, I finally had a chance over the long holiday weekend to download the Horn Show podcast for shows that I had missed during January and February. Did not have a chance to hear the February 18th show if you returned in time to have one. I didn't, because my internet access is still so very, very limited. Really only have two ways to access the internet these days. Both of them are strictly time limited. Cafe across the street from the side street where the house I'm staying in is located. This cafe has electrical outlets for laptops, and the people who run it are very friendly, but much to my regret, the cafe is only open to 5 p.m. on weekdays and 3 p.m. on Sundays. So if I go there and order a hot chocolate and or a muffin, I perhaps can get about 2 hours of solid work done involving the internet. After 5 p.m., if I need to do more, I need to go to the Safeway supermarket about two doors down. It's wonderful to have a supermarket within walking distance in a city that's not necessarily known for adequate public transportation. But unfortunately, although the Safeway offers free Wi-Fi and is open till 11 p.m. every night, I think they had in mind helping those customers who have smartphones. Several of the clerks will check their iPhones when I ask if the Wi-Fi is up and running properly. I don't think Safeway anticipated me coming in there with a laptop. So in fact, there's no accessible electrical outlet, small part of the Safeway, where there are tables and chairs, four sets, for people to sit down and check their digital devices. Or to be more accurate, although I've looked all around the vicinity of this customer space, I have not yet found any electrical outlet I could use. Accordingly, with an old laptop whose battery only gives about 2.5 hours at most when the battery is fully, completely charged, I only have about 2 hours in which to get any further work done at the Safeway. And it's usually not feasible for me to go home and recharge the laptop and then return to the Safeway. I usually don't leave the Safeway until 8 or 9 p.m., and by that time, there's not enough time to recharge my battery. They close up sharp at 11 p.m. So, for the foreseeable future, I'll only be able to listen to your show by podcast after the show has aired. This past long weekend, this is neat. This past long weekend, I got from January 18th to February 6th in terms of listening to the podcast. And he notes that some of the podcasts are repeats or don't include the full 3 hours. Those are things that are related to either me forgetting to send Ben a note or the recorder not working quite right. But there was also a problem insofar as while we were in D.C. That would happen because we would bounce in and out of connection because of some of the technical problems we had with the equipment. But Harry continues. I've enjoyed all of the shows, and like Tracy said in the show of February 6th, I believe, your show, The Horn Show, keeps me sane. And when I finally was able to listen to a number of past shows this past weekend, I could feel my blood pressure going down and my self-esteem rising. It was such a relief to hear sane monologues from someone as bright, as funny, as progressive, and humane as you are. Okay, this is the part where we're going to have to get Agnes to come in and put the C-clamp on my head to keep it from swelling. That's awfully kind, Harry. And your conversations with listeners are always a delight, so I had a few small comments to leave with you. Please tell everyone I'm hearing the shows on podcast and have been so delighted to listen to all of the callers, whether they be veterans and old hands of the Horn family or more recent listeners who are just beginning to enjoy a public affairs radio show
They're so carefully thought out and so sensitively conducted. Please tell everyone, from college student Cassie to our wise and seasoned senior citizens, that I've been so relieved to again hear intelligent, sensitive, and thoughtful conversations on a three-hour radio program. He says, I'm glad you got to see San Francisco. The beauty of California does indeed seem to inspire the public in California to want to protect what they have. Please keep hammering away at anything that is not progressive or not humane. You're a uniquely learned voice on the very progressive left, and we all, perhaps especially, need you to rally and inspire us. And finally, it's your show. And in my humble opinion, it is one of the great shows on radio right now. Perhaps the only great show on radio right now. Thank you, Harry. Thank you. We look forward to when things getting squared up, straightened around, and hearing from you during the live broadcast. To go back for a minute to, well, we were talking about Marsha Blackburn, who doesn't like Social Security, who doesn't like preschool, who doesn't... local control. We can keep. Yeah, we tried that local control thing. Had to be fixed with a series of cases that started with Brown versus Board of Education, if I recall correctly. So no, Marsha. No, Marsha. No local control for you. But it does take me back to. Well. When I shared the information about her response to the idea of raising the minimum wage and her rather blatant display of the ignorance that makes one wonder if, well, how she managed. The autonomic nervous system is an amazing thing. Nobody has to tell her to breathe. If she had to think about it, well, she'd asphyxiate. But anyway, that the point about the we can't raise the minimum wage has to be counterpointed with this story that I'm sure our buddy Ron in Raleigh is well aware of. Has to do with something that North Carolina Repiglick and Governor Pat McCrory did today. Ron warned us last week, I think it was, that this was coming, and yea, verily, lo and behold, and forsooth, it has happened. North Carolina has the fifth highest jobless rate in the country, in the union. 45 states in the United States have lower unemployment rates than North Carolina has. North Carolina, that President Obama says is the model for how we need to go forward. Said that last week, didn't he? North Carolina, that's one of the most anti-union, most labor-hostile states in the union, where, naturally, the Democratic Party had its convention. Yeah, that North Carolina. Well, North Carolina's unemployment rate is 9.2%. The National Employment Law Project issued a press release today decrying the fact that Governor Pat McCrory, Repiglican, signed into law a piece of legislation, a bill, that guts the very idea of unemployment compensation in that state. Because Republicans hate things that benefit the working class. See? I said it. Did it right. The working class. What this means? according to the National Employment Law Project, is that, among other things, North Carolina will lose federal emergency unemployment compensation aid as of July the 1st of 2013, a scant 5 months, less, just a little more than 4 months away. What that ultimately means is that 170,000 American citizens who happen to have the misfortune of living in North Carolina, Stan, will be denied federal unemployment benefits. Now, that's 170,000 unemployed North Carolinians, not 170,000 people. Because those unemployed North Carolinians have children, have families, have hopes to continue having a roof over their head, have a positively inexplicable desire to eat food and have water service and maybe even electricity. Governor McCrory has said to hell with all of that. Interestingly, he did not have a private ceremony, or he did not have a public bill ceremony to sign this piece of garbage into law. He did it behind closed doors, all sneaky-like. There were friends. The law was written by the North Carolina Chamber of Commerce, among other helpers. National Employment Law Project says it bluntly, many North Carolinians will now go from struggling to barely make ends meet to outright struggling to survive. And they also point out, the National Employment Law Project, that it's going to whack the state in general, because unlike the 1% who get a tax break and stuff it in the mattress, the working class has to spend its money. That is by design, of course. Can't have them saving up and becoming part of the 1%, because then the 1% might be the 2%, and hell, where's the fun in that? Exclusivity is what it's all about. What's the point in having a club if you can't limit who gets into it? So all that money that was coming in by way of unemployment benefits, a little bit here and a little bit there, will no longer be spent. It won't be spent on power bills. It won't be spent on food. It won't be spent on so-called big-ticket items. It won't be spent on medicine. It won't be spent on tires. It won't be spent... Oh, you get the idea. NELP says, in its haste to shield businesses from paying somewhat higher temporary federal taxes to pay off debts resulting in part from a wave of earlier tax breaks, North Carolina lawmakers have taken a hatchet to the unemployment insurance system, causing undue hardship for tens of thousands of families and thoughtless harm to the state's economy. The governor may have decided to sign this bill in private, but the impact of what he and the legislature are doing to the state's economy and to people whose only crime is an inability to find work cannot and should not escape public condemnation. Now I'm going to ask an asshole question. Reckon how many unemployed North Carolinians, if they voted at all, went to the voting booth and voted for McCrory. Reckon how many of them looked over and said, well, it sure looks like he's got family values. We need us a family values governor who will protect the little fetuses. We can't be having that Muslim Kenyan socialism. How many, you reckon? If your thinking is along the same lines as mine, that number is probably higher than any of us would care to admit. Disgusting, isn't it? The law, if you've ever lived on unemployment, you know it is not a walk in the park, despite the fact that the Repiglicans, the same people who were wrong about minimum wage, destroy the economy. Well, they're wrong about unemployment compensation creates a culture of dependency, and we want people out there looking for work. Well, the maximum benefit allowed in North Carolina was $535 a week. With this law having been signed, with this bill having been signed into law, the maximum benefit per month or per week will now be $350. By the way, remember, that's taxable. Because it's still deemed income. Meanwhile, the maximum number of weeks you can be on unemployment will drop from 26 to 20. North Carolina, as noted, has just taken itself out of the running for $780 million in federal unemployment funds. Is it time to get Tobacco Road out and read it again? By the way, cutting the available maximum number of weeks from 26 to 20, well, square that up against this fact. The average unemployed person in the U.S. has been out of work for 35 weeks. How do you search for work when you're starving? How do you search for work when you can't keep a roof over your head? $1,400 a month doesn't buy much in North Carolina. How do you make the rent and the power and the water and the sewer and the garbage? How do you do all that? How do you make the car payment? How do you make the car insurance payment? I guess Pat McCrory's answer is, I don't know, and I don't care. Here's the fun part. The Repiglican Party in North Carolina calls this a re-employment program. Yeah, then they'll get out there and they'll take whatever we got and we'll pay them whatever we want and they'll be damn glad to have it. Let's see. How about a little math on the fly? Here we go. $350 a week. 350 divided by 40. Yeah. There you go. There's the objection. Well, hell, $350 a week is still, hell, that's better than minimum wage. That's $8.75 an hour. I mean, that's $7,000 in, that's $7,000 in 20 weeks. Hell, that's pretty good living. Except it's not. They don't realize it, but they're making some of the most compelling arguments there are for a minimum wage boost. Who are we kidding? The minimum wage should be $16, $20 an hour. But it isn't, and ain't going to be. This is one of those moments when you realize that the demographics really are going to have to change in this country. Maybe after this generation of pasty-faced, doughy, hateful white people moves on, maybe when this nation is no longer a majority white nation, I don't know. Jack writes in from Shreveport and says, you know, we shouldn't forget that the focus by Republicans that it's only the federal government that they want to cripple is BS. They're trying to destroy the effectiveness of government at all levels, from the states to the school boards to the city governments. They want to destroy all the government, governmental local control, too. Yeah, right, exactly. It's about hating the idea of government altogether. It's about resisting the idea that more people should be included in government rather than letting it be run by an aristocratic elite. Because, see, that's how it was originally set up, and they're still not over, you know, them women folk are getting the vote, and then we got to let the people with, you know, the coloreds, they got to, and the Mexicans are going to vote, and well, damn, it just ain't no fun no more. Jesus. What's that look? Is it just because we can't see them, or perhaps the for-profit media won't cover them? I mean, how do you do a news story on things you can't do? $170,000 people in a state with how many millions? You reckon news team coverage 12? Is going to be out there looking for somebody not buying soup? Because Lord knows the homeless population is all but invisible to the for-profit media. We are rapidly moving toward, if the Republicans have their way, a resegregated nation. You know, not with the overt stuff that comes of things like Jim Crow laws. They've become just a little bit more subtle. This is going to become a nation where being born in one state is a curse, and being born in another is a blessing. And isn't that what the pre-1965 America was? Where if you were born in a state with slightly more humane laws, you had a far better chance not of getting ahead but merely surviving than you did if you were born in Alabama or Mississippi or Tennessee or Georgia, etc. I can't get around the idea that that's where we're going. That is ultimately the reality that we're going to live. And every one of these decisions makes it a little more likely. I'm still deeply bothered by the... I recognize the realities involved. But I find myself forced to confront a resegregated nation that arises out of the Obamacare decision by the Supreme Court, where access to Medicaid determines one's ability to actually survive, and access to Medicaid is left to political hatreds and political whims. The realities are that stark. In a Medicaid expansion state, even with something like this where unemployment gets crushed, you could still conceivably go to the doctor if you're sick. But for states that don't opt into Medicaid expansion, it's what Alan Grayson said. Die, and die quickly. How much further, and this is not hyperbole, this is a serious question, how much further are we then from things, from other nasty 19th and 18th century institutions like the workhouse? Because it doesn't seem like a very long trip at all for me. Or to me. Or maybe for me. Jesus. The Republicans are in a race with time. They have to tear everything down before they lose their power to project their privilege. We, on the other hand, have to try to stop them. And it is indeed a race. And it seems like they're winning. But enough of that. Let's go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
This is Edward.
Hi, Edward. How are you?
I'm fine, and I am just absolutely flabbergasted with North Carolina. My family has lived in eastern North Carolina for over 300 years. And people out here ask me, well, why did you move out here? North Carolina is so beautiful. And I said, yes, but my family has lived there so long, if you shake a tree, one of my cousins will fall out of it unless they hold on by their tail, because there is such a thing as devolution.
Well, this certainly seems like an example of it, doesn't it?
It sure does, and I better hang up before I say something real tacky.
Well, you know what? I passed the joke along, and I've gotten a laugh every time I've told it.
Oh, well, good. Heather would love it, wherever she is.
Well, I mentioned her by name, so.
Well, thank you very much. She would appreciate that a whole lot.
Well, Edward, you have yourself a good evening, and take care, and we'll talk soon.
Yeah, well, watch out for those those North Carolinians falling out of the trees unless they hang on by their tail.
Prehensile that they are.
Take care.
Bye now.
Bye.
Edward calling from Texas. Is that it? So, is that what these predators and parasites are? Are they just devolved? there's something missing from the gene sequence in a Republican. I don't. It's as possible as anything. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob, how you doing?
What's happening, Jim?
You and your program.
Well, I thank you.
That's about all I can say.
No, I saw your note just a minute ago. I saw the Mark Sanford story too. You got it. If nothing else, you give him style points for brass. I made a mistake, and now I'm back.
Yeah, and I guess he's going to do pretty well on the dismount too. But of course, from who is he going to dismount?
There you go. I was going to leave that one for you. I sensed a punchline on the way.
Yeah, as far as North Carolina is concerned, you know, hello, dude boy.
Yes, indeed.
And I cannot understand why they would reject that federal money, unless what they're trying to reestablish, and I hate to say this, it would appear to me as though they're kind of, in all these states that you refer to, what's the end stand, they're trying to reestablish the Confederate States of America.
I'm convinced of it, Jim. I'm absolutely convinced of it.
Just never gotten over that, and they just can't handle it, and now they think that they have a chance to reestablish economic Jim Crow laws.
Yeah, Jim Crow, and not, you know, not entirely racially motivated, but more economically motivated.
Yeah, it's totally economically motivated. And
but, I mean, consider all these states that won't opt into the Medicaid expansion, for instance, they are literally turning down billions of dollars in money on a situation or for a situation in which the first 3 years are paid for 100%, and after that the rate never drops below 90%. And yet there's Lindsey Graham saying put Obamacare on the table because he wants that Medicaid expansion dead, Jim, dead.
Well, they will, in my opinion, put it on the table. I mean, I don't think people realize how dangerous this sequestration thing is and exactly the impact it's going to have. I mean, if you can't shut the government down one way, you do it another.
Where does this idea come from, Jim? Because, you know, it first really, really began getting traction with Ronald Reagan. This idea that being self-governing is a bad idea. How can people... Are they just so benighted, Jim, that they never consider the roads they drive on? They never consider that when they open the tap, clean water comes out, and that all of that is a function of government, good government?
You know, I don't think that they really have sense enough to realize that, or if they do, they're trying to. They have some type of arcane method in the works in which they can basically become the masters again of so many plantations. You know, plantations don't have boundaries, Bob.
No. No, they don't.
They used to have physical boundaries back before 1860, and now what they want to do is reestablish, well, I hate to say it, the Old South. As much of a part of my family that has been, and have admitted to on this program, but I've never agreed with it.
But and that Old South is now not just the South, though. It's going to extend into Kansas and Missouri and Idaho.
It's going to expand eventually into California. They're having their problems out there, too.
Sure.
I mean, you know, California, even though it's been like, what is it now, the ninth largest economy in the world, used to be the fifth. Someone can correct me on this.
No, I think you're right.
But I mean, basically, what they want to do is reestablish the antebellum
economic system. And we're talking about wage slavery, lack of representation, hooray for me, to hell with you.
Yeah, and consider that the legislature that passed this bill and sent it to the governor's desk in North Carolina is, what, the first Republican legislature in 100 years? And they wasted no time whatsoever getting busy doing the work of 100 years ago.
Well, these people are just totally atavistic. And they, like I said, they want to go back to a position in which they feel like they can control, and to hell with the federal government, and to hell with the benefits of federal money and federal efforts. I mean, you know, the president did mention in his State of the Union speech our infrastructure.
Yes, he did.
And he did mention what I had said to you a long time ago, that report coming from the American Society of Civil Engineers.
That it's crumbling, falling apart as we watch.
D minus. And I guess maybe they want to get out there victorious and saddle up their horses and ride around on mud roads and stuff like that and have the people they don't particularly care anything about put back in the slave quarter. You know, there's political slavery, there's mental slavery, and there's economic slavery. And it would appear to me as though that's what their ultimate end objective is. Maybe I'm wrong. I hope I am. But I don't think
you are. And the question is, well, like the sequestration debate now, as Andy pointed out, Jim.
Oh boy, that's going to be a real, real barn burner.
But all of a sudden, it was entirely, totally, completely the idea, the brainchild of Barack Obama, and the Republicans were trying to hold back the forces of evil Kenyan Muslim socialism, but he got it through. And then that whole meme is utterly at odds with facts and history. But it'll be all over the for-profit media it already is.
That's all you hear today, and the impacts of it. And Congress is in a 9-day recess.
Yeah.
And as far as the government shutting down again, as I said before, if you can't shut it down one way, you're going to shut it down another. But what this is a political war of the roses. It is a bloodletting operation upon which this country is performing exsanguination upon its own body.
Well, there's never been a case yet of a good bloodletting making anybody better.
Don't think so. Don't think so. You know, I was watching, of all things, this weekend, John Jake's North and South.
Oh, my. Patrick Swayze.
Oh, yeah.
Very young.
And now due to pancreatic cancer, very gone. And all the other stars who were on it, too. I mean, a lot of those people are just totally gone. But some of them played some pretty good roles in that thing. And there was a lot to be learned in looking at the attitudes then as opposed to attitudes now. It just appears to me as though there's an effort on the parts of certain people to reestablish that situation.
Makes me wonder what the...
Our social structure and...
Yeah, it makes me wonder what the world that my grandchildren will live in is going to look like.
Well, I don't know. but it doesn't seem to be doing very well. And the thing that these people can't realize is as far as this huge debt with which we are encumbered, how it originally started.
Well, you know, that brilliant piece of work that Rachel Maddow put out last night, Hubris, about the start of the Iraq War.
Oh, yeah.
There's the answer to the question.
Really? And the lies that were told. Dick Cheney, again and again and again. Colin Powell, oh, yeah. And there was one guy who actually worked for Colin Powell when Colin Powell made a statement to the effect of pushing the Iraq War, made marginal notes in his day book, and they were trying to establish the thing about Osama bin Laden and Saddam Hussein. And even Colin Powell admitted, what the hell is there a connection between Osama and Saddam Hussein? They both hate each other. Saddam Hussein was a total, you know, secularist as far as this Muslim jihad is concerned. And I thought to myself, what in the hell? How could we have been put, have some of, have this thing put over on us? I mean, we've gone in there in Iraq and destabilized the country. We're fighting a war in Afghanistan that is totally unwinnable, unsustainable. I've said that many times before, and I'll say it again. And it's and that was the
and real, it has led to economic ruin for us.
Yeah, it has. I mean, you know, in 2000, we were in pretty good financial shape. Not the best, but we were in pretty good financial shape. A hell of a lot better off than we are now.
And yet, out there, you're going to laugh, Jim. I saw a headline on a blog post that was dealing. You know about George W. Bush's email getting hacked, right?
I haven't heard that one yet.
Yeah, his email got hacked, and some stuff was released out into the cyber sphere, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
The headline of this piece is "Greatest Living President is Also Fantastic Painter." George has taken to painting, Jim.
Really?
Yes.
I wonder what style he's following.
I'm guessing it's the connect the dots style. Or paint by he's apparently entered an introspective phase of his life, and he's doing self-portraiture. So one of the paintings that he mailed to his sister was of him. It's a painting of his back standing in the shower, looking at the little shaving mirror that depends downward from the shower head. I'm not kidding.
You're kidding.
No, sir.
I would certainly hope that it's...
Don't make me send this to you, Jim. You don't want this happening to your evening. No, the other one is a self-portrait of him sitting in the bathtub. It's a self-portrait of his of his legs, his knees sticking up out of the bathwater, and his toes sticking up out of the bathwater.
Please. It's a shame that he does not include the image of Charlotte Corday.
Well, this article, "Greatest Living President is Also Fantastic Painter," says that, let's see, the paintings demonstrate a command of line and color that is rarely seen in the modern-day art world. Former President George W. Bush appears to be influenced by such painters as Edgar Degas and Edouard Manet. The portraits also clearly capture the personality of their subject. Winston Churchill also painted.
Oh, I don't think so. I think not. George Bush in a bathtub. Does he have his boots on? Does he have a big old back scrubber up there, and he's still wearing his cowboy hat?
Oh no, no! It's his naked toes, naked knees sticking up out of the water.
Oh my God! Wonder where they're going to hang that.
I
guarantee you, you'll have.
I'd like to see him hanged at The Hague.
I'll guarantee you one thing: they'll probably find some way to make some type of coffee table book out of it, and it would amaze you to see the people who would buy it.
Sweet, yeah.
And I would love to see the psychological interpretations of people who review paintings and things like that. For example, the old masters, like.
Who was it that invented or discovered that perspective? And it was a painting of Christ after the crucifixion, you know, laying down. And you know, what's the name of that technique? Well, George's legs in the bathtub is reminiscent of that.
Well,
it's painted from the perspective of his eyes looking at his knees and his feet sticking out of the water, with the water running into the bathtub.
So they're going to try to make some type of pietà out of George Bush?
You said it. I didn't, Jim. But, yeah.
That's pretty sad. I wonder how many renderings there will be.
Well, so far the only ones that were unearthed were these two. Of him standing in the shower and him taking a bath.
Oh, I'd love to see those.
Well, I will try to remember, and I will send you the link.
Well, please don't forget. But going back to the sequestration thing, what's the drop dead date on that thing? Friday?
I am not sure.
Now, exactly how will this impact by 1 March?
Well, it's... It's not going to be a government shutdown per se, but, you know, look, here's a reality, and it's kind of at the forefront of my mind since I just got done flying around the country. The FAA, the folks who write the paychecks for the air traffic controllers,
number one, okay,
will have their budget slashed indiscriminately. So that means we'll be down a few air traffic controllers.
All right.
7.5% cut from the Pentagon budget. Now, how that will be applied, I don't know. Does that mean? You're not going to reduce paychecks by 7.5%.
That will be applied through smoke and mirrors, Bob. That's just.
But I don't think it's smoke and mirrors with the FAA or the FDA or EPA,
the National Parks Administration, the EPA, or some of the other governments.
Right. Consider the National Park Service.
Yeah. I mean, you know, are they going to shut them down?
I don't see how you don't.
I don't either. I've looked at it.
This is the Republican Party doesn't want to own it now, but they were excited about it because this is another way of getting austerity into the body politic of the American experience.
Without any thought of the impact of the danger and the dissolution of the union.
Yeah. I think they really are trying to gin up some sort of revisitation of secession and dissolution.
And school lunches.
Sure.
What else is on their...
Well, I mean, what about food stamps?
That's another one.
But ultimately, it'll also affect things like farm subsidies, will it not?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the American farmer, who is the mainstay of this country, is going to be adversely impacted by this because, you know, if you don't have those federal farm subsidies coming in, you're going to have the food supply severely impacted. And they don't seem to care. I don't understand it. I just don't understand it. I mean, this whole sequestration thing, exactly how was it born? If you can please inform.
Well, it was born out of the debt ceiling debate.
Right. They think that they're going to pay off the debt ceiling over what? How many billion years? Over what? 10 years or something like that?
Yeah.
Dollars over 10 years or something like that.
It came about as a function of the Budget Control Act of 2011.
That's right. That's right. And everybody signed on to it. And basically what they did was kick the can down the road and not deal with the problem as it was or as it should have been dealt with. And having
you remember that thing also created the super committee?
Oh, yeah.
Which then just sort of disappeared down an alley somewhere and was never heard from again.
I don't know. Like I said, you know, it's just incredible for me how they invent these ideas and these bodies to implement these ideas. But yet, when the due date comes, and it's the drop dead date, how are they going to deal with the effects?
And the mechanism of it is that the sequestration operates by taking the budget number and if government spending exceeds the budget the previous budget resolution, then spending is automatically cut across the board.
Well, it's very comforting to realize that we have butchers up there instead of wizened economic brains determining what the fate of the country is going to be. I mean, this is going to be some bad stuff. And I hope, against hope, that they will come to some type of resolution. But even if they do, they're going to put it back a couple weeks or a couple months to this, that, and the other, while arcane forces lay their plans to try to do something else. Let's face it, they're going back to Grover Norquist. They want to destroy government and buy
drown it in the bathtub.
Exactly. And on that note, I'm going to leave you and let somebody else get on this line.
Well, Jim, you have yourself a good evening, and I will send you the Degas-esque art of George W. Bush.
Well, good. I
suggest you get the scotch bottle handy.
No, I think Imitrol would probably.
Or maybe a little laudanum.
No, I'm afraid you can't get that anymore, but Imitrol.
And more's the pity.
Oh, yeah. Okay, well, listen, take care.
All right, you too, Jim.
Bye.
Bye now. It's our buddy Jim. Let's see, let me take care of it. By the way, I put the link to the George Bush paintings in the chat room. Just look, if you want to Google it and see it for yourself, greatest living president is also fantastic painter. That gives you the shivers. I don't think anybody necessarily completely understands what would get cut in sequestration. Now, obviously, Lindsey Graham is excited at the possibility of, you know, hacking away at life-saving measures and so forth. Jay writes in, says, the Repubs did not care what was in the sequestration bill because they were sure that they would win the presidency and then could change everything. Yeah, and that's very true. Remember, they were absolutely convinced not just that Bishop Willard Romney was going to win, but that it was going to be a landslide. Dick Morris found out to his dismay that his landslide predictions were, and of course there was the fit that Karl Rove threw on the air. It cost Dick Morris a job. But I think Jay's point is very well taken. Going back to the issue, remember Marsha Blackburn. Lines are open, 304-658-3333, or Bob Kincaid Horn on Skype. And we've got about a good solid 30 minutes of potential conversation left in the evening if you want to join in. But remember, Marsha Blackburn didn't like preschool, universal preschool, because of all that paperwork. Well, let's go over to Radio Rwanda Business News. And one of their blondes, a woman by the name of Jerry Willis. Who picked up where Radio Rwanda plane left off, calling it, you know, a nanny state. Educating children is a manifestation of a nanny state. It got it. Well, here's Jerry Willis on preschool.
I mean, no doubt about it, and I have to tell you, I think it's immoral to make all these promises when you know at the end of the day you can't afford it, we can't afford it, to say preschool for everybody. Are you kidding me? We don't have the money for that. He also promises mortgage assistance, $3,000 for everybody. This is just crazy talk, and I think it's immoral to put this across as something that's actually doable when it's not.
Preschool is immoral. You don't want to educate them little proles. They'll be out there thinking thoughts and getting all uppy and wanting to eat whenever they feel like eating and have clean water. And, well, hell, next thing you know, it's just straight. It's a straight line, a straight road right there into your Kenyan Muslim socialism. Welcome to 2013. Again, where the education of children is an immoral act, but a pissant 7.5% cut to the Pentagon will destroy the United States of America. You heard Jim. Those cuts aren't going to mean anything. They're going to be handled by blue smoke and mirrors. Think Progress says that there are $11 of economic benefit, $11 of economic benefits over a child's lifetime for every dollar spent initially on preschool. That probably adds up to some real money real quick. Teen pregnancies go down when you have preschool. Dropout rates go down when you have universal preschool. Criminal conduct goes down when you have universal preschool. So I don't think Jerry Willis really has a real handle on that word, immoral. But that leads me to something that Texas Betsy sent in that I wanted to make sure we shared this evening. She titled it Dispatch from the 21st Century Classroom. Remember those teachers that Marsha Blackburn was talking to? She needs to talk to Texas Betsy, I'm thinking. Because it sounds like the teachers that were talking to Marsha Blackburn were probably I don't know, Confederate heritage teachers or something. Texas Betsy writes, since returning to the regular classroom last August after 14 years working primarily with students who were exempt from testing for one reason or another, I've mostly written about what's happening in fifth grade. Overwhelming focus on testing to the exclusion of everything else, total disregard for the calendar because the schedule is so tight, the far greater importance given to data over students, and so forth. Well, the journey continues. Since we last spoke, Texas Betsy says, it turns out that even other elementary grades don't teach social studies. The reason my students in fifth grade have no historical context is because it is largely not taught at any other grade either, at least in my school. The district curriculum actually has goals and objectives for social studies for each three-week period, including a textbook, page numbers, and even essential questions, but if we don't schedule time for it and only allow social studies that easily integrates into the language arts book, it turns out that no one really focuses on history or social studies at all. Leading us to, none of my students know the names of any recent presidents besides Obama. A few had heard of George W. Bush, but know nothing about him, and no one could identify Bill Clinton as a former president. I cannot tell you how incensed I am at this lack of emphasis on social studies. How are the middle school and high school teachers supposed to create educated citizens who are ready to vote when they're leaving elementary school with no idea which century each war took place in, and can't name more than 10 states or find more than 5 on a map? Social studies is tested here in the 8th grade, and so the elementary schools feel free to ignore it completely. My district ignores the calendar, except when it's silly. We ignored Labor Day and September 11th and Columbus Day. My grade level within my school did some Thanksgiving activities, mostly because it was a 2-day week and we couldn't start and end a chapter from the language arts textbook. We then ignored Christmas, except for dressing in red or green or as a character from a Christmas book, not a holiday book. Never mind that some of the teachers and several students are not Christian. We then ignored MLK Day and the inauguration. I taught inauguration on the slide because we'd spent some time on the election. Shh. We ignored Constitution Day, which is a federally mandated celebration, and now we're in February. Black History Month. Bulletin boards and snippets on the announcements, but with no historical context, it's all meaningless. For a student who has never heard of the Civil War and knows nothing about slavery, how much meaning will he or she get from the test practice passages on Rosa Parks or Jackie Robinson? But we do celebrate Valentine's Day. The party is only allowed in the last hour of the day, which is fine, but this means that the kids spent all day hiding their lists of boys and girls because they can't possibly give the same kind of Valentine to both, and tomorrow will be lost to sneaking peeks into the closet to see what goodies we'll enjoy from 1:35 to 2:35. Then there's science. Science is something we actually get right in many ways. Lots of hands-on activities and connections to other disciplines, lots of demonstrations and the chance to write about them, but the curriculum is largely presented online using materials that are projected onto the whiteboard or screen, but every single lesson has typos and grammatical errors. Finally, a note on the future. I spoke with a second grade teacher after school who was born in 1984 and has been teaching for 7 years. She is as frustrated as I am with our school and the micromanagement of guided reading lessons beyond ridiculous. But far more disturbing was her comment that even if she did what I am currently doing and applied for private school jobs, she wouldn't know how to teach any other way because this is how they taught her to teach when she was in college. Other than her own elementary school experience, which she remembers fondly as being theme and project-based, she has never seen any other teaching style except teach to the test. Be very afraid. Really. Signed, Betsy. P.S. Back on my head, have to enter 1 major and 2 minor grades in the gradebook for each subject by Friday. Now, that's a snapshot of on the ground what it looks like in an elementary school in the United States, in the fifth grade. We are forever being taught, told about how we've got to be able to compete in the 21st century with workers in another. Blah, 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 blah. Makes it sound like they want to send six-year-olds to trade school to start learning how to use a damn bandsaw. You want to compete with student? You want to compete with the rest of the world? Maybe we might want to think about, yeah, history, social studies, yeah, geography. That was part of what Betsy was talking about. But how about languages? All those up-and-coming students in the other parts of the world begin being exposed to second languages, what, second grade, first grade, preschool that we don't have? And by the time they're in sixth grade, are probably fluent in that second language, which is often English. Or certainly acceptably fluent, for a sixth grader. If you listened carefully to what Betsy wrote, yeah, we should all be very afraid. We all get a good giggle out of the Mike Judge film Idiocracy. But it's not so funny when it begins to come true. Can't identify what did Betsy write? Can't name more than 10 states or find more than 5 on a map. And don't comfort yourself, or don't think you're comforting yourself by saying, well, yeah, it's Texas. Because it ain't just Texas. That's America. But in some places, it is worse than others. Imagine Alabama. Imagine Eastern Kentucky. Imagine West Virginia. It is a terrifying reality to even begin to contemplate. If you don't know where you are, how can you tell where you're going? Can't name 10 states? Can't locate more than 5 on a map? And I guess I really have reached my geezerhood. Because that stuff was deemed to be important once upon a time. I mean, you can do American geography on the test, but I guess it's not on the test, so screw it. If that local control that Marsha Blackburn was talking about involved involved less teaching to the test and more actual teaching, I'd be all for it, but no. Remember, teach to the test is something that was born out of the Bush administration and No Child's Behind left. We have literally lost a decade of students, a decade of opportunity. What does that mean when those students who weren't taught in 2005 are out there in the workforce in 2045? Yeah, that's a scary country. That's a terrifying country. Let's go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Good evening, Bob. How are you?
I'm well.
This is Isaac.
I thought it was.
Bob,
Bob.
What have I done?
You have North Carolina. Okay?
Okay.
Edward and Jim talked about it. And, you got less than 30 minutes, so I decided I will vent, if you don't mind. But, I have some dealings in the state of North Carolina. And I used to commute back and forth from Columbus to North Carolina, I guess from 2001 up to 2009. Commute back every other week, stay there about a week and week and a half or 2 weeks, and then come back up north and stay a couple of weeks, you know, because I had an office down here too. And, beautiful state.
Absolutely.
I mean, just the skies and the land and the people, really, really nice.
They got Appalachian Mountains that don't have coal under them.
Yeah.
There's nothing more beautiful than the Smokies.
Yeah.
By the way, before we go too far down the road, Isaac, another mention of something going on in North Carolina. They are at war with nipples.
Yeah, I saw that too. I've seen that in Asheville. Yes, I did. I saw that. The protest they had going on there. But you know I have a but.
Yes.
Coming about North Carolina.
Sure.
Now, for all the Horn listeners who currently live in that state, you know, I hope you enjoy this. If you don't, if you're sensitive, it's time to turn it off. Because I have to let people know about North Carolina and my dealings with them. The state is backwards. If you want to get something done, it is totally backwards. Just my personal experience. I'll give an example in getting a car registered. All right. Now, I'm from the Ohio area, and we're used to, you know, when it's time to get your car registration renewed or license renewed or whatever, dealing with your car, you go to the Bureau of Motor Vehicles, which are all over in the city of Columbus, as an example. And you go there, you know, if your tags are expiring your birthday, also your license. Okay. Not in North Carolina. It might have changed now because, you know, I left there in 2009, but in my dealings down there, if you had a car that was registered, let's say for example, you know, your tags are up for renewal in June. Okay. So you have a number 6 in your driver's plate on your license plate. But your birthday is in November. Okay. So that's the 11th month. So, and they also have what is called to get your emissions test done on your vehicle, which I don't understand because I don't see any steel mills but it's in the entire state of North Carolina. Okay. Now, in Ohio, we only have a couple of cities like Cincinnati and I think maybe eastern Ohio where you have to get an emissions test, but Columbus and other areas where there's not a small problem, it's not a requirement. But in North Carolina, you have to get an emissions test, and you have to get that done. And that may be required to get that done in March. Okay, so you got 3 dates you got to remember throughout the year. Okay, and what is so odd, to get your license renewed, you have to show proof that your emission test was done. And the only place at that time that you can get your emission test done was at Jiffy Lube. Not at Valvoline, not anywhere else. You had to go to a Jiffy Lube to get that.
Well, that's a nice racket.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And the thing about it, too, if you're late, let's say that your sticker states you need to get your emissions test done in March, and if you are late and you go in April 1st, you get a $25 fine on that. Okay? And so you have to have all these documents present when you have to get these certain documents, you know, your license. Oh, and here's the other kicker, too. If your tags are, you need new tags in June, as an example, okay? Go there to get your tags done, okay? And let's say that you want to update your license, get your license done. You stand in line for hours, and you go up there, and it's time to get your tags done. And he says, I want to get a license done. Okay, that'll be fine. All right, so what do I need to do? Well, you need to go to another facility, and that's across town. I was like, are you serious? You know, and then if you go across town to get the driver's license done, if you need to get something done with your car, you have to go to another location. They're not in one confined location.
And another thing, too, one of my other gripes I have with them, too, the state are bill collectors for the private sector. There was an example of a person I was dealing with down there when they were getting their license renewed. They couldn't get their license renewed because they owed a cable bill from Time Warner. And to get the license renewed, you also had to pay to the state the bill that you owe to Time Warner or any other entities you may owe money with. And I'm just like baffled, and I'm asking people, this is not right, you know, and they're like, well, it's always that way down here. I said, but you guys can stand up and say something, this is not right. And Time Warner is another example, too, because I had Time Warner cable internet service in Columbus, and at that time it was like, for I was paying per month like $66, okay? And so when I ordered cable in North Carolina, there was no competition. You could only deal with Time Warner. They had the entire state at that time. So you call them up and says, okay, I'd like to get, you know, internet access, cable TV, and phone service. How much is, you know, get it set up, you know. And I'm thinking, well, the price, you know, I'm paying 60-something bucks in Ohio. Down there, no. They're talking about $135 per month. I said, whoa, this is Time Warner, you know, big corporation all over the country. Why are the rates so different? Well, we're the only competition here in the state of North Carolina, so we can do this. I mean, it's so crooked on everything that I've noticed, and I'm so glad I have no more dealings with that state. I can go on, you know, but if you have any questions. You
know. No, it's... The funny thing, though, is you're describing it, Isaac, as between your the way things operated in Ohio versus the way they operate in North Carolina. But I think we can extrapolate further that it's every bit as crazy in any other southern state.
And they charge sales tax on food. They looked at me like I was crazy. In Ohio, they're not allowed to charge sales tax on food here in Ohio. You know, when you go to McDonald's in the drive-thru down there and the dollar meal, you know, it's 99 cents for a hamburger or, you know. And
the hamburger's 99 cents.
Up here in Columbus it is.
Yeah, but in...
But down there is a, you know, they tell you, well, that'd be $1.08, sir. You have a nice day. Oh, what's the extra 8 cents? Well, that's state tax. You got to pay sales tax on your food down here. And that's injustice.
Well, but see, it's the way things operate in the South, Isaac. You know, they hate taxes if the taxes are going to be imposed on people who have money. On the other hand, however, they're happy to impose taxes on people who don't. It's the heart and soul of the political and social philosophy of the Deep South. The people who pay are the people who have less are the people who pay more. Regressive taxation is the watchword south of the Mason-Dixie line. Whether it's a food tax or gasoline taxes, I mean, we've got stupid gasoline taxes in this state. And, of course, those fall inequitably. It's the nature of regressive taxation. It falls inequitably on the people least able to pay for them.
Did you see the news story that I emailed you yesterday? And I just re-emailed it to you about Sidney Lowe arrested for baseless tax charges?
Yes.
North Carolina again. What state does that? Where if you don't file your state income tax, they arrest you. They arrested this man for not filing for the past 3 years his state income tax.
Jesus.
If you read that story.
Yeah, no, I did. It.
Put him in jail for not filing his state taxes.
It's amazing. But it's amazing to someone who thinks, Isaac, in terms of rational policy. It's not amazing if you just that's how the South operates. Because the South operates, Isaac, on this idea that every state really is a separate country. And they do, you know, and they do these stupid things at the bidding and behest of the people who have the money, and so they put it on the backs of the people who don't. Just got a note in from Jack in Shreveport. He says, Bobby Jindal is trying to do away with the state income tax here and convert to a sales tax. Once again, like Jim said, the goal is to destroy government as we understand it and replace it with something, with some creature of their devising that will be much more to their liking, because it will do solely their bidding.
Oh, I got another one too. Interstate 40, I was in Raleigh. That's where I was at, in Wake County. And riding down Interstate 40 on the freeway, just minding my own business, and you know, they got the little cops on motorcycles and little race cars zooming by. Another thing too, everybody thinks they're Mario Andretti in North Carolina. They love driving 90 miles an hour too, I noticed that too. But, I'm driving on the freeway. Cop rides by me on the, motorcycle. And he passes me, then he slows down. And he looks at my car while he's driving his motorcycle. And then he turns on his lights and motions me over, you know. And I had a car with, you know, Ohio plates. And so I pull him over. You know, I'm going to speed limit. What's going on? Well, to give you a little background, at that time in the state of Ohio, you know, it was not a requirement that you have your seatbelts on, okay? Well, apparently, I guess they have that law in place, you have to have a seatbelt. But in Ohio, what I'm used to, the cops not allow...
It's not a probable cause offense.
That's right. But this guy's riding by people's cars and looking in their cars and giving tickets. Oh, and here's another one, too. I was in Durham, downtown Durham, taking care of some business, and I parked at a parking meeting at City Hall in Durham, okay? And take care of some business and everything, and I come back out. There's a ticket on my vehicle. The ticket was that I was parked 18 inches away from the curb. I'm supposed, the law is you're supposed to park within 12 inches from the curb. And that ticket was $95.
Jesus, criminy.
Yeah. And you can't fight it. I mean, you know, I'm going back out of town and everything, and I mean, I could have fought it, but I had to come back down when I, you know, because I was purchasing my flight tickets at the time, or either when I drove down there, you know, made arrangements ahead of time, but that's like, this is sending the $95. I'm so glad I don't have to deal with that state anymore.
And yet, it's worth remembering, Isaac, that the operational philosophy of the right wing in this country is to make every state in the union more like the southern states, where people, because it's a matter of brutalizing. You know, a $96 ticket can cripple some people.
Yeah.
Financially ruin them. You know, no food for you this month. Imagine.
Around with a measuring stick.
Yeah. But that's not surprising coming from a place that had. You know, that would hand a voter a Chinese restaurant menu written in Chinese and tell them that that was their literacy test to be able to vote.
Yeah.
You know, it's sad. It's
in you know, in the 21st century, this is going on down there.
Yep. It's hard to fathom, but fathom it, we dadgum better well do. Because that's what's coming. I mean, you know, I've got this Wisconsin crush going right now. I love that state. I love going up there. Well, that's not, you know, there was an election up there today, a Supreme Court election. And that's going to have incredible importance going forward. But I'm looking at a post right now. Wisconsin Republicans forcing women to undergo transvaginal ultrasounds is priority. And they're doing it via something called the Woman's Right to Know Her Unborn Child Act. So she's pregnant, but she doesn't know her unborn child.
Well, this is a question I ask some people sometimes. I'm going to ask you. Do you see any light at the end of the tunnel where America's going to stop becoming stupid?
I am becoming more and more pessimistic, Isaac. If I was completely pessimistic, I would not be working on the AIC Act. But, for instance, something like the AIC Act, we work on it because it is a way forward. These struggles that people are individually engaging in, whether it's the AIC Act here or whether it's the struggle that my friends out in Wisconsin are in to keep their community from being destroyed in the name of in the name of a mining company. These are those are little flickering lights at the end of the tunnel. But the problem lies in connecting the dots between them. Because when you're involved in one of these things, you tend to think of it in intensely local, very close focused terms. And the one thing we progressives have not been particularly good at over the years, and even Van Jones pointed this out, is acting collectively. And it was a couple of years ago when I heard him brilliantly point out, and he said, Republicans hate collectivism, they say they hate collectivism, but they march lockstep together whenever they're called upon. On the other hand, we as progressives, we value group dynamics, but we have a devil of a time acting together. You know, we tend to compartmentalize our universe. You know, this is a labor issue. This is an environmental issue. This is a women's reproductive rights issue. When in point of fact, they're all human rights issues, and we don't see that. We have a very hard time. So, is there a light at the end of the tunnel? There could be one, but it is dependent upon people figuring out that this is one big struggle. And so if you want an answer to the question, well, that's it. In the moment where we understand that this isn't some sort of compartmentalized esoteric exercise, that this is life and death, and that it's life and death everywhere it happens, and that this goes all the way back to the poetry of John Donne, okay? No man is an island unto himself. And we don't have a real good grasp on that. Unless you know something I don't know. You know, hopefully this past Sunday was a step in the right direction. 35 to 50,000 people freezing on the National Mall calling for the XL pipeline to be done away with.
Well, I know that, but hold up,
that's a start.
Michelle and the kids were snowing. They were skiing in Colorado, and the old man was down there playing golf with Tiger. So he found it convenient to leave town when they were doing a protest on the Keystone.
Yeah. Not surprised.
Yeah.
And you know, the other problem that attends all that, I don't want to be seen or heard as diminishing a tremendous effort. But facts are facts, and you know, by Monday everybody was gone.
Mm-hmm.
And there you go.
And I didn't see CNN or.
The coverage was minimal at best.
MSNBC was doing prison porn, so, there was no coverage, in my opinion, from what I saw.
I mean, they in a way, they covered it themselves because they had a live stream out there. You could see everything that was going on, and I don't know what kind of viewership or listenership they had, but it was an attempt, it was an effort.
Yeah, it's just messed up, you know, just messed up. But, you know, I'm not going to give up, you know.
No, you can't. I'm not suggesting that by any stretch of the imagination. It's not a matter of giving up. It's a matter of recognizing reality and working harder. You know, my dear friend and leader, Judy Bonds, lay dying of cancer that probably was somehow related to the world she had lived in, living next to a coal prep plant for years and years and years. And as she lay dying, she said to us, fight harder. And I take that very seriously.
Well, you got 5 minutes left. I just want to come in and help kill some time with you, but also give you my angst about North Carolina. Beautiful state. Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful.
And nice people.
Yeah, well, yeah, they're very, very nice. It was funny, because when I used to try to get business done or something done, you know, I'm from the north, so I'm, you know, if I'm asking for something, and he's standing there in line, he says, okay, we'll get that taken care of, sir. So I'm standing there waiting. Okay, well, how long would it be?
Yeah, they didn't tell you when, did they?
No, they'll start off talking about, you know, we sure did get a lot of pollen today, didn't we? What the hell has that got to do with my car? But, you know, but I understand. I had to slow down because, you know, I mean, very, very nice people. But they'll talk about everything else, you know. You know, Margo's doing great in elementary school. Ain't she? You know, okay, I want to get my car fixed. but they're nice people and very good. Pool port. Oh, I love the pool port. But,
oh, yeah.
But business-wise, ugh, I can't stand it. I'm used to getting things done.
I understand that. And some of that's the north-south dichotomy. But what you're talking about is, well, it's just not very good government. That's all you can really say about it. But now it has officially gotten manifestly worse.
And it's not going to change if the people down there don't say something that this was wrong. You know, the attitude, when I talk to people about it, they were always saying that, well, it's always been this way. But it's not right.
And it hasn't always been that way. It really hasn't. Well, Isaac, you have yourself a good night. I am glad you called in, though. Right,
okay.
It was a good conversation.
All right, then. You guys take care.
All right, you too. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Calling from Ohio, that's Isaac. And so we find ourselves at the end of this Titanic Tuesday. It's awfully good to be back behind the microphone. Back tomorrow night, too. Do please remember, we are entirely listener-supported here, and we've got a long way to go to finish out February. And February's more over than there is yet to come. Only 9 days left. And I sure don't want to go through another one of those things we went through earlier. Yuck. Thanks to everybody who makes all of this happen. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff, Lottie and Sparky and Betsy in the chat room. Thanks to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thanks to John Fox. Thanks to Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks to the hardest-working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and yes, AcheAct.org. Go there and be a part of the solution to mountaintop removal. And always, 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 Gina, Judy, it's all for you.
Rick Smith is next on the Horn.